Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill speaks with Dr. Eric Hall, Senior Chancellor at the Florida Department of Education. COVID-19 has made every student a distance learner, and the two discuss how blended education can create greater equity for less resourced families. They discuss the agility of Florida Virtual School to serve as both a COVID-19 safety net in the event of anticipated rolling school closures in the fall, as well as an expanded resource for a full-time shift to blended learning for families who want it. All that and more in this episode of Podcast Ed. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
We're here with Dr. Eric Hall, who is the Senior Chancellor at the Department of Education in Florida. Welcome, Eric.
It's good to be with you. I appreciate the invitation, Doug, and just the opportunity to have a conversation.
Well, we're excited to have you. Give us a little bit of your background. I know you came from North Carolina from here, but you actually were in Florida previous to that. So why don't you give people a little bit of sense of where you've been and where you are now?
Yeah, so for me, you know, I grew up primarily in Florida. I grew up in Pasco County. My parents are both public school teachers, and I went to University of South Florida, really for all three of my degrees. I mean, I must have really enjoyed it because I've, you know, spent a lot of time at USF over the years.
Right.
And went into, actually was a classroom teacher, and then worked in non-traditional education, a lot with alternative education, juvenile justice education. Really, you know, love that system when you talk about trying to create new opportunities for students that,
right,
in some cases, we're trying to navigate barriers and overcome hurdles and get themselves to the point of graduating high school and looking at post-secondary opportunities, and just, again, really enjoyed that work, and kind of grew up around that kind of, you know, educational setting. You know, in my career, became a school administrator and worked as a school leader, and went around the state doing a lot of turnaround work, working with juvenile justice and alternative education programs doing turnaround. And then ended up being in a situation where I had a portfolio of 26 schools here in the state of Florida.
Wow.
Then had an opportunity to serve on a national level where I had a portfolio of 56 schools in the states of Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, Texas, Louisiana, Illinois, up into Virginia, and was doing some work even in New Mexico. So it was just an opportunity to kind of get a nice perspective of the country and what was happening in the areas of education, and really looking at that intersection of, you know, not just education, but you know, mitigating risks that, you know, could be challenging to some of our students that were in alternative education and at risk of dropout. After doing that for a while, loved it, and had an opportunity to go to North Carolina about 7 years ago and serve as a CEO for a statewide organization that partnered with about 170 schools across the state of North Carolina, working with a lot of students and just partnering with a lot of districts to do things that we could to make sure that students had the supports they needed to, again, graduate and mitigate those barriers that sometimes would, you know, get in their way, whether those were academic barriers or non-academic barriers to success, which, you know, could have ranged everywhere from basic needs to coordinating mental health and other social supports that students just needed to, again, overcome some of these hurdles. And after doing that for a few years, then went into a path of doing a lot of work with economic and workforce development, serving on the state's workforce board in North Carolina, and eventually found my way to working for the State Board of Education. Was hired by the State Board of Education to start a new statewide school district in North Carolina that was focused on school turnaround, and partnering with districts and with local communities to look at those schools that had the greatest needs, and from there was promoted to serve as the deputy state superintendent, to work with our state superintendent and state board on the policies and the, you know, important work of things like test reduction, expanding school choice. Charter schools was an area that was in my portfolio in North Carolina. And then I got an invitation to come back home to the Sunshine State about a year ago to work with the commissioner and help support the work and the bold agenda that we have here to continue to build on the great foundation that Florida has in education.
So what kind of work are you doing now? I know your original title was Chancellor for Innovation. I now guess you've been already promoted to a senior chancellor.
I think a lot of it was just really kind of clarifying my role. I mean, I've really been in a position here where, you know, I work as a direct support to the commissioner and working really kind of overall the program areas, you know, working with our Office of Early Learning, our K-12 system, working with our career and adult education system, our Florida College system, vocational rehab, our blind services division, and then working with our Office of Articulation to you know, make sure that we have the policies and conditions in place so that students can navigate, you know, between our systems the way they need to continue their post-secondary pathways. So for me, it's an opportunity to really kind of have this lens and view that bridges everything from birth up to post-secondary and see where we blur those transition points in a way that helps support students to get to where they need to be successful. So really consider it a blessed opportunity and a unique situation to be able to support, you know, not only our commissioner and our governor in things that are important to our state around policy, but also looking at how do we pivot to, again, address the comprehensive needs to ensure that we're doing things like being number one in workforce education, doing things that have state standards that, you know, take us from Common Core to having standards that are going to be the best in the nation when we get to full implementation, and doing the things that ensure instruction and curriculum and overall delivery of what we're doing with assessments, all of those things collectively coming together that continue to make Florida the number one in the country, you know, in education and what we're doing to support post-secondary opportunities.
Obviously, we're going through some pretty dramatic changes right now. School in August will look very different than school in January and different than school in May. You know, so what's your best guess of what are things going to look like when we reopen in August? I mean, a lot of people are talking about, with social distancing challenges, some kind of a hybrid model between homeschooling and brick and mortar schooling, and, you know, what's the right role of online education? What's your sense of what it's going to look like when we reopen? And then I want to talk about innovation. I mean, what are the opportunities here that we can use to raise the bar? But let's first, what's your sense of what it's going to look like in the fall?
Well, I think to give us a sense of what it looks like in the fall, maybe talk about what it looks like right now. And I was, you know, fortunate, I was just on a webinar a little bit ago with some other state chiefs and talking about, you know, what does reopening look like? And, you know, somebody asked the question, you know, about, you know, is there anything that we've learned with schools being closed? And I had to pivot back quickly and say, well, first and foremost, schools didn't close in Florida.
Right.
What we did is we had a transition from our brick and mortar facilities to distance learning and virtual learning.
Right.
And our districts and our schools really stepped up, in my opinion, to pivot very quickly to go from these brick and mortar settings, these classrooms, to getting our teachers, our school leaders, and our districts, everybody pivoting in a way that got our students on these platforms to continue their academic progression. Now, is that an ideal situation? Was it something that didn't come with a lot of learning and growth? But I think as a state, we have a lot to be proud of because, again, our educators and our school leaders, you know, they really took this step to be agile and get us in a place to do that work. And I think that comes with, you know, a long history of policy and practice that we've built up a degree of agility to know how to navigate these systems and structures while, you know, unfortunately, this is creating, you know, challenges that are statewide, not just located in a particular region as we try to recover from things like hurricanes, but the statewide impact, you know, it gave us an opportunity to build on the things that we know how to do well, which is to manage emergencies. But at the same time, having things like Florida Virtual School and virtual platforms that have been an expected component of our system, it allowed us just to deploy in ways that some places may not have been, you know, as inclined or as ability, have the ability to adapt in such a way like we did. So I think with that, looking at the fact that we've got, you know, all of our schools, you know, delivering virtual instruction, distance learning in different ways, I think what we're doing is we're going to look at how do we kind of pivot and transition into the summer. So I think before we jump all the way into August, let's talk about what summer looks like. Right now, you know, as we're preparing to look at the end of the school year, we have many of our districts and schools are starting to come up and ask questions about, hey, how do we provide summer programs? We have organizations out there that oftentimes provide summer programs, you know, at the school sites. We have VPK, you know, voluntary pre-K program that oftentimes has summer programs taking place. How do we make all of our big bets around student achievement and look at how we're going to address some of the exacerbated, you know, concerns that could come out of an achievement gap because of this additional time out from in front of a direct face-to-face instructional model with our teachers in the classroom for those students that, you know, we know benefit when they have a great teacher in front of them doing great things. But I think to that point, you know, using this time over the summer, looking at what we do to potentially open summer programs, get our VPK programs, you know, up and running, you know, we have to look at what kind of accommodations and, of course, keeping safety and health at the forefront, looking at what kind of things we need to do around social distancing, elevating sanitation. You know, are there things, and this isn't a conversation unique to Florida, every state's talking about how do you maybe monitor for things like, you know, taking students' temperatures, you know, before they come on campus. All these different factors are things that both in the summer and then as we prepare for the fall, to ensure the safety and health of our students and our staff and getting those things in place is going to be, I think, a real big pivot over the summer to prepare for the opening of our schools in some way, shape, or form come August. And so I think that's kind of the steps between now and then. And then when August, you know, kicks off, I think we're going to take those lessons learned, work with our partners at the Department of Health, have our districts work closely with their local health agencies, and get those conditions in place to mitigate, again, the safety and risk concerns that we know in the end is on everybody's mind. So we've got to give parents, families, and our local communities the confidence that we are ready to reopen by knowing that these safety steps are in place, and then get our students where they need to be in front of the great teachers to get the instruction that they deserve.
You mentioned the Florida Virtual School, which is obviously a real jewel in Florida. Been around since, I think, 1997. The largest public school in the country. It's, you know, statewide public school. I see that they've just ramped up to serve 2.7 million kids, you know, this month. They do some pretty cool things. You know, both my kids went through Florida Virtual School. There's a lot of customization, almost by definition, you know, a lot of competency-based learning, which we've been talking about since well before you were born, when I was in graduate school. Everybody sort of dreamt of a day that you got to get away from the one-size-fits-all to much more flexibility and competency-based system. They have a really cool funding mechanism, as you know, which partially funds based on student achievement, which is very innovative. Are any of the innovations from Florida Virtual School, will some of that stuff begin to bleed over into the districts as we move into a more of a blended model moving forward?
You know, we definitely have a jewel in Florida Virtual School. I mean, it's a great resource. We have states around the country looking to Florida right now and saying, how do you do what you do and how did you build up that capacity? And well, you know, Florida Virtual School had been built to do certain things and reach a certain number of students. The leadership at Florida Virtual School, we ramped up quickly that capacity to get to the 2.7 million and are well on our way to reach, you know, the ability to serve 4 million students.
Wow.
Bring out, you know, tools and resources to where if we absolutely had to, there's nothing that would prohibit every student in the state of Florida being able to access that as a resource and a tool for curriculum content and train local teachers so that if I'm the teacher sitting in a classroom in a particular district, my kids don't have to move to another teacher on Florida Virtual. Being able to train teachers to where if they need to use that as a platform, you know, if that's the direction their district and their schools were to go during periods of time when it might be needed or to extend the learning opportunities for students. We're trying to look at how do we create agility around that so that, again, it becomes a good, strong safety net if and when needed and continue to build its capacity to serve the state the way that we might need it to in periods of time where we might have, you know, rolling closures and openings. And and I think that's going to be the real innovation going into the fall is that when you look at the, you know, the research and the evidence that continues to come out on a daily basis about how we can do testing for COVID-19 and how can you do contact tracing in a way that, you know, helps us to look at, you know, steps that aren't about closing down, you know, an entire, you know, campus, for lack of a better term, or an entire school district and moving everybody to virtual, maybe even getting it down to a science where, you know, hey, contact tracing might show us that, hey, it's just this one classroom that has a concern. So how do we quickly contain, isolate that situation, maybe move students into this short-term virtual setting and not lose any instructional time, get those conditions in place, do the sanitation in that classroom, and then maybe get those students back on campus a week or two later to continue the instruction face-to-face directly, you know, in a classroom with their students. It might mean that there's an entire wing that we have to do something with. But again, the science over this next year and the sophistication that comes hopefully over time with the testing and the capabilities to do that kind of contact tracing, I think that's going to give us the agility we need to ensure the safety and health, again, of our students and our staff, while also recognizing that, you know, school is no longer confined to that brick and mortar setting, but we can extend it and use a degree of agility that in some cases we hadn't conditioned ourselves on this scale to do before. And I think that's where, you know, some real innovation is going to come. And I've heard, you know, been talking again with other state chiefs that are having these conversations. And I think, again, Florida's well positioned because of the infrastructure and the things that we took, not just here recently to build out more capacity, but what we've done over the long term to make sure that we see the value in having virtual platforms in that intersection of virtual learning coincide with our face-to-face direct instructional models that exist in our schools across the state.
That's fascinating, Eric. I mean, to have that kind of agility on the fly to move from physical brick and mortar to virtual and back and forth and be able to do it in a way that you don't lose the kids in the transition is pretty amazing. I'm going to talk a little bit about equity. You know, there's been a lot of dialogue, and you mentioned also about not exacerbating the achievement gap as we go through all this. You know, we've been working, you know, Step Up serves a high poverty population. We've been working with your team, looking for ways to get more technology in these hands of families. You know, as a parent, the kind of things you do for your kids outside of school. You know, for me, when I was a kid growing up, I did a lot of sports almost all the time. You know, I sort of went to school so I could do the sports after school. And a lot of what I learned as a leader and as somebody who learned how to do hard work was all part of the sports activities. But you know, it costs $500 or $600 now for a kid to do Pop Warner football. And so how do we begin to think about, as more and more learning moves off campus, how do we make sure that the achievement gap doesn't get exacerbated because some kids have all these resources at home and other kids don't? I mean, to have Eric Hall as a dad, you know, that kid, your kids won the lottery, right? I mean, they've got a professional educator, very skilled, but you know, a lot of kids don't have that.
I'd be remiss if I didn't say I have a great wife who also is doing a great job with that work. She's also an educator, you know, and works in our education system, so I get that. But part of it is, how do we use the resources and tools that Florida has available to do good diagnostics? You know, we've seen great tools out there. Our districts are using progress monitoring assessments. You know, how do we use that data to inform how best to intervene and engage and start addressing some of the things that we need to do, you know, with our students? And I think regardless of where a child is going to school, you know, information is what drives the ability to intervene and provide the supports that you need to at the individual level. And we got to get down to really being, you know, to me, in my opinion, we got to be the national experts in that space. We've got the tools with progress monitoring. We've got other data indicators that we can use because we are a state that's been built around strong accountability measures. We look at accountability not, you know, as a way, it's not, accountability sometimes gets framed as, you know, it's this strict, rigid, you know, set of policies and guidelines that may come across punitive in some people's minds, but it's really not about punitive. It's about giving parents, families, and in this case, our educators, the information they need to provide the greatest supports to meet the individual unique needs of children. And I think that's where, again, Florida is well positioned, has been a national leader in that space. So I think as we look at going into the fall, and how do we, you know, create the conditions within our schools to be responsive and use data to drive instruction, we're just going to have to double down on that. I mean, that's how we're going to close gaps. We got to look at, you know, what are the big bets that we're going to take going into the fall? And part of that's going to be, you know, again, I talked about the conversations. Are we going to look at some summer bridge strategies to look at steps, not just our summer programs that we typically have, but do we do something maybe a little bit different to help support students that need some additional supports before the school year starts? Rising kindergartners, I just, you know, we're hearing a lot about that. You know, are we going to do things to help support the students that missed out on, you know, part of their VPK year? Are we going to do things that, you know, accelerate some of the learning loss that our kids that have been in K through three getting ready now to rise up to fourth, you know, first through fourth? What are the things we're going to do there? And how do we, you know, differentiate in a way that helps to make sure that we have highly effective teachers in front of those students that need the greatest support to close those gaps and accelerate, again, learning in a way that closes those gaps? You know, that is to me is going to be the great differentiator. Some states might struggle with that, and we've got to make sure that Florida is not one of them. I mean, we have a great track record in closing gaps, and it's because we have a robust choice environment. Right. You know, we have conditions in place that have empowered parents to make the best choices for their children. And in doing so, we got to make sure that we work hand in hand with our educators and our school leaders of all different schools and make sure that the tools are there to make sure that we're using data to drive, again, what we know is in the very best interest of each individual child. And for that, we got to double down. We got to hold ourselves accountable as a state collectively to making those things happen. And that's going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take a high degree of agility. And I think some of the lessons coming out of what we've been dealing with, you know, here with using distance learning and virtual education, hopefully we can extend the classroom beyond just the traditional school day, right, to maybe even expand, you know, some additional content options for students that, you know, might need additional support.
A lot of things we're mentioning deal with technology. And I've been in this business well over 40 years now, and we've always struggled to use technology to improve productivity. But it feels like we've got no choice now. And so I'm kind of interested in how we might start seeing technology evolve in new ways. I mean, you mentioned learning in a community, learning at home, learning at school, integrating that, getting parents more engaged than they ever have before. Do we use Zoom in ways that allow families to be actually in classrooms at times, you know, when appropriate? And use Zoom to bring the teacher into the home at times when it's appropriate? And maybe use Zoom to bring the parent and the teacher and the kid into a boys and girls club when it's appropriate? I mean, are there opportunities there to really begin to think outside the lines and integrate communities in ways we've never done before?
So to answer your question, yes, but I'm also gonna give that with a caveat that I am truly a firm believer. Maybe it's because, you know, my parents are both teachers. I was a teacher. I don't think there's anything out there with technology. I think technology enhances great teaching.
Right.
But it takes the great teacher behind all of that to make it work and to be effective. And whether that teacher is, you know, in front of the, you know, the students themselves in a classroom, or whether they're delivering instruction through a virtual platform, the fact is we got to make sure that we don't ever get to the point of convincing ourselves that technology is going to replace a great teacher.
Right.
But I think where you can extend and really, you know, accelerate certain functions of what happens in teaching is, it's just that. I mean, how do you extend learning into the after school hours? How do you, you know, provide access in a way that students on the weekend can look at good content?
Right.
And, you know, whether they don't have access to books in the home, how is there reading content that can be delivered through virtual, you know, mechanisms, so that, again, students are reading and they're building that literacy, you know, framework in order to be effective and proficient over time. You know, to me, that's the great divide that we have to conquer in this time is, you know, we've kind of had this new subgroup of students emerge, which are those without devices and those that lack, you know, internet access. And while we've been talking, you know, for a long time, you know, probably over a decade now, about this digital divide, I think what this has done is it's forced us to move quickly to identify where these gaps are and mitigate those gaps as quickly as we can. And so that's where I think, again, we can be proud. We've worked to realign resources. We've worked with, you know, districts and schools to say, how do we get devices where we can into the hands of our children? Working with internet providers to make sure that, you know, again, there's internet access where we can, or buses that are Wi-Fi enabled, or businesses that are saying, hey, look, come use our Wi-Fi. We got to continue to be intentional with that, because if not, then we're going to still see this subgroup of students that, again, are represented by those without access. That's where the gaps can grow by leaps and bounds that we got to figure out how to mitigate. So again, our big bets, I think, going into next year is going to be around closing the gaps. There's no doubt with that. I think to your point, when you talk about how do we use these tools in a way that maybe we haven't done before, you know, I think about, you know, that parent who is at work and maybe can't get to an IEP meeting,
right?
Because they'd have to take off work and potentially lose income during that time. Well, they might be able to step out and take a 15 to 20 minute Zoom call, save themselves an hour of drive time,
right?
And be in a Zoom meeting to participate in an IEP discussion about their child.
Right.
It could be that student who needs additional, you know, support with their counselor, with their social work, that now the parent can be engaged and do, you know, instead of it being a home visit, you know, that has to, you know, require people to travel or go do certain things, or potentially risk, you know, coming in contact with, you know, something like a, right now we're in this age of COVID, how do we mitigate risk? We have social workers and counselors that are using these tools to engage with parents in ways that over time, I think, can just continue to enhance what we already do with our schools and with our staff that are working with parents and with families.
Wow, that's exciting. And you guys have done amazing work, Eric, and I wanted to thank you on behalf of all the citizens out there that you guys have done. It has been amazing, and I just want to say thank you. Any closing thoughts that you'd like to share? You've been very generous with your time, and I appreciate it.
No, I mean, like I said, you know, we have a lot of things that we're going to continue to learn. And like I said, as we're building out strategies with, you know, statewide, you know, reopening of our economy, we know that education plays a major role in that. You know, whether it's working families are dependent on high quality childcare and on high quality BPK to have their children ready for kindergarten, how we're going to work to double down on achievement gaps and closing those gaps with, you know, a high degree of urgency and just really building the capacity of our educators, our school leaders across all spectrums to be able to get things in place. We're going to have a lot of work this summer, but I think, again, the future is going to be bright for Florida. We're going to come through this, we're going to grow, and we're going to, again, set the stage for everybody else in the nation to look at when it comes to being able to use these things in a way that drives great improvements for kids. And again, I don't think you can go wrong when you bet on teachers and you bet on school leaders and you do it in a way that builds their capacity to do the work that needs to be done for students. That's the formula for success. And that's where, again, I think our commitment is going to stand up, and we're going to come through this in a way that, again, is a game changer in learning, growth, and this experience.